For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We're going to be in Daniel chapter 2 tonight, talking about a dream that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had that raised all kinds of ruckus, and which also offered an opportunity for God to stand in there and reveal himself. So it's a great little passage. It's fairly important, actually, as we unroll what the book of Daniel is all about. This is in some way sort of the starting point to the visions that God gives Daniel. So let's just jump right in. It's kind of a long section. It starts in verse 1. The second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king gave orders to call the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the priests to tell the king his dreams. So they came in, they stood before the king, and the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand it." Then the priests spoke, and they said to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation." And this was the way that it happened in the ancient world, and a world where there's a lot of sensitivity to what's happening in the spiritual realm. Dreams meant a lot. And the interpretation of these dreams and visions that people had was sort of, it was a business, really. And there's a whole industry around animal entrails and tea leaves and things like that to define what is the meaning of this vision or this dream. And so what we are reading here in Daniel 2, the first few verses, is really a fairly familiar thing given the ancient world's animistic beliefs. Actually, you don't have to go very far from Columbus, Ohio, to be immersed in cultures that are still very much this way. But going on, it says, "The king replied to them, 'The command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me both the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a trash heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive gifts, a reward, and great honor, and therefore declare to me the dream and the interpretation.'" Okay, so this is a little different. And so this is really going to separate the wheat from the chaff, the posers from the real people who have the connection there and can understand these things, as he's demanding not merely that they interpret something in whatever way, but also that they prove that they understand it by telling them what the dream was. The priests answered a second time in verse 7, "Let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation." And the king replied, "I know for sure that you are bargaining for time, since you have seen that the command from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have together agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation changes. So tell me the dream so I can trust your interpretation." So now it's just making it a little bit more clear. I need the dream. You need to tell me what I dreamt and its interpretation. And if you can't do that, well, we're going to do the old drawn and quarter thing, which is where I tie each of your limbs to a horse, all oriented in different directions. I crack the whip, they go, and so do you. And so that would be a really dismal way to end, but that is what is at stake. "The priests answered the king, saying, 'There is not a man on the earth who could declare the matter for the king. No great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of his magicians, conjurer, or priest. Also, the thing that the king demands is difficult, and there's no one who could declare it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh.' At this, the king became indignant and very furious, and he gave orders to kill all the wise men of Babylon. 'What good are you anyway? I know you're all just a bunch of posers.' So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the king of the king's captain of the king's bodyguard, whose job it was to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, "Why is the decree so urgent?" And then Arioch told Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went and requested more time from the king so that he could declare the interpretation to him. Then Daniel went to his house and told his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about the matter so that they might request compassion from the Lord, the God of heaven, concerning this mystery, and that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Okay, so that's the setting for our story here. And it really focuses on this affirmation that these wise guys make, which is that there is no one who could declare to the king what his dream was except for a god, because, you know, no one has access to the mind of another person other than a god. That's just knowledge that you can't have. And so to have it would be to be in contact with a god, or to, in fact, yourself be a god. And, of course, that is what Nebuchadnezzar is saying. If you say that you speak for God, then there has to be some proof. And he really is putting out a test here, namely, how you'd know it's really from God. That's right. No BS. And so the Bible is all about the BS test. And in fact, this is an example actually tonight of a broader understanding that goes all the way back in the book of Deuteronomy, chapters 13 and 18, when the whole Israel thing was getting going from the very beginning. God said that he would raise up seers and prophets and people through whom he would reveal himself, and that these would not be like the magicians and the conjurers that were known throughout the ancient Near Eastern world, people who would just make up little narratives, little stories, and kind of schlep that off as somehow wisdom from God. No, the prophets of the Old Testament, and Daniel, of course, is one of these, are people who are receiving messages from God that are of a very specific sort. And some of the dimensions of that really come out in this passage. I want to just think briefly about three of them. One is that they possess supernatural knowledge. The king says, "Tell me the dream." It's not enough that you give some interpretation. Anyone could make up an interpretation. You've got to demonstrate that you know something that no one else could know. And so, for instance, in Deuteronomy 18, in describing the work of the prophet, God says, you know, the prophet, to be identified as such, needs to give a short-term prophecy, something that's verifiable. And if that thing should come to pass, then you can trust him and identify that here is a person through whom God actually is speaking. And so supernatural knowledge and some evidence of that is important. Second, that the interpretation is specific. You know, the king was troubled by his dream. He knew that something was at stake. And so the interpretation and the voice from God is not trivial. It's not like fortune cookies. Like, for instance, I went on Googled fortune cookies this afternoon thinking about this. You know, it's not like a rich partner is ordained for you, or your personal finances will be greatly improved. Oh, really? And when might that be? You know, begs those kind of questions. You have a yearning for perfection. And just so on and on and on. You all have had the fortune cookies. You know what that is. It's just sort of platitudes. They don't mean anything at all. They're completely worthless. But it's kind of nice to think about them because, you know, they're always so positive and stuff like that. But not so when God speaks. He doesn't speak to the trivial. And he doesn't speak to the ambiguous. He speaks to the specific. And it's on target, and it makes sense. It's not some, well, what does this really mean anyway? But it has a clear meaning to it, as we'll describe here in just a few minutes. And also, of course, that it's verifiable. When God speaks, he speaks of things that will occur, not just things that might occur between your two ears, you know, or a feeling that you have or something like that, but to events as they actually happen, because as we'll read here in just a second, Daniel knows that ours is the God, the Lord of history, and that even the moving of empires and nations is subject to his knowledge and even subject to his approval. And so when he speaks about the future, it is confirmed in the very record of history itself. So that's the framework. Now let's get into it here. That's the background. In verse 19, Daniel, it says that the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And this becomes then the first of several visions that Daniel receives that are recorded in the book of Daniel. And then Daniel, it says, blessed the God of heaven. In other words, he's just expressing his intense gratitude that God would just grant him this insight into the way things are, and this privileged supernatural knowledge that can only come by God granting it to us. It's not something that we could figure out on our own. And so he said, and this is Daniel's prayer. He says, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. He reveals profound and hidden things. He knows what is in darkness, and the light dwells with him. And so to you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise that you have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. And just, you know, the gratitude that's there, and just this approaching God saying, I believe, God, that you are the God who speaks. You're the God who reveals what is occurring in your creation. You have the wisdom, you have the power to bring these things about. It's just this awesome and beautiful statement of Daniel's trust in the living God. You know, for some of us who are like, we like to read our Bibles and kind of meditate on the scriptures, one of the things that I think is really kind of sweet is to look at the many prayers that are in the Bible. And there, it's a window into the heart of people who really know God. And just to kind of allow that kind of to percolate into your mind and into your heart, and just gives you that lens to begin to see things, you know, more and more God's way. And this is one of those things. I've been thinking about that this week. It's just been kind of edifying to stand there with Daniel and to affirm that ours is the sovereign Lord, and that he, in his graciousness, his mercy, has chosen to grant to us knowledge that no person, regardless of how gifted and intelligent and so forth, could ever have, but that God, and just because he's gracious, chooses to give it to us. Isn't that sweet? Well, he goes on. It says, therefore, in verse 24, Daniel went to Arioch, who the king appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon, and he spoke this to him. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man among the exiles of Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. Well, that had to just be good news for everybody involved. And the king says to Daniel, whose name had become Belshazzar, are you able to make known to me the interpretation I had and make known to me the dream I had and its interpretation? And Daniel answered, as for the mystery about which the king inquired, listen, understand this. Neither wise man or conjurers or magicians or diviners are able to declare it to the king. Okay, this is not a human thing. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries and has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in later days. And so again, he just brings Nebuchadnezzar's attention right back to God. This is not, I'm not a great man. I'm not a special man in any way. I'm no different than you or anyone else, but I know the God of heaven. And this is an expression, a figure of speech, the God of heaven. It's used repeatedly through the narrative in this chapter. And it's just basically to say there is a God in the singular. Not many gods. There is one God. And it is only through understanding his will and purpose that we can understand anything that matters at all. So I'm not so unique. I'm not that smart. Daniel's saying to Nebuchadnezzar, I'm just in contact with somebody who really is. And so he goes on. As for you, O king, while in bed your thoughts turn to the future, and he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. Okay, so that's real specific. The dream is about what's going to happen in the future. As for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind or your understanding. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a great single statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of the statue was made of gold, its breast and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay. And you continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell its interpretation to the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over the earth. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes partly of clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have the toughness of iron. As the toes were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men. But they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. In the days of these kings, the God of heaven, again he's using that expression, will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put to an end all these kingdoms, and it will endure forever. And inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, bronze, clay, silver, and gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. Both the dream and its interpretation are trustworthy. And then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him the offering and fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, surely your God is a God of gods and Lord of kings and revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery to me. Okay, that's weird. Okay? It just is. It's a weird story. And so our job tonight is to understand this weird story and how does it relate to anything in the Bible? And of course, how does this relate to us? Why does this matter? This weird story of the statue, which I envision looks like this thing that I stole also from the internet. That's the sum of the king's dream. Then, of course, it gets smashed by some gigundous rock that then fills the earth. But you'll notice as Daniel explains the dream and explains its interpretation, that it fits these general non-BS qualities that we talked about a few minutes ago in very crucial ways. First, in terms of its value to the king, of course, the king was aware that he had a dream that he had spoken of to no one, that no one knew, and that if someone was going to know it, it had to be that they had knowledge coming from God, and that this exile from Judea, this guy named Daniel, possessed that knowledge. And so in that sense, for Nebuchadnezzar, this was a very powerful and confirming experience, wasn't it? Now there's only one problem with that. It's not a powerful and confirming experience to me. I didn't have the dream, or to you. You didn't have this dream either, and so we can kind of sit by the sideline and say, well, you know, so what? I'm really glad Nebuchadnezzar had this experience. I'm sure that it was very uplifting to him, knowing that he's a head of gold and all this kind of stuff, and that there is this knowledge that comes from God that this servant of his possesses. That is good. But what about us? And this is where the passage really starts to come into focus in a crucial way. That in the dream of the statue and the interpretation that God gives to Daniel, there is a framework for specific, I want to make this clear, specific and verifiable visions, predictions about the future that the book of Daniel speaks of on a significant level in chapter 7, 8, 10, 11, and 12. A series of four visions that absolutely connect thematically because they are all about, as this one is, they are all about the future of humankind's rule on the earth. They are all connected in that way, and they are all about these four kingdoms that vie for control of the earth. And so whether it's a statue with four elements on it, gold, silver, bronze, and iron, or four animals, as in chapter 7, where Daniel says these great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. Similar things can be said about chapter 8, where two of those beasts are focused in on with specific detail. And then the last of these kingdoms is described for us in chapters 11 and 12 especially. So the point here is that we are introduced to the very explicit idea that Daniel is receiving a series of visions, just as Nebuchadnezzar did, that there are four kingdoms about which God has concern and over which, at the end of the day, God will prevail, establishing his own kingdom on the earth. That much is explicit. That is what has been said. So our question here this evening then is, what are those kingdoms? Why does it matter? Well, the first, the head of gold, is without any doubt a description, a reference to Babylon. Because that's what it says. Daniel says in chapter 2, verse 38, when he's telling Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation of the dream, he says, you are the head of gold. Right? That's not ambiguous, is it? That's very clear. There's not much wiggle room for, well, I didn't really mean this and I didn't really mean that. He says, you, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. And then after that, He makes reference to a second kingdom, the kingdom represented by the silver, which is actually the kingdom of Persia. It says in verse 39 here, he says, in interpreting the dream, he says, after you will arise another kingdom inferior to you. So who comes historically right after Babylon? Well, we all know just through looking at, you know, a history book, that that is the Medo-Persian Empire. But Daniel mentions it specifically in chapter 8, verse 20. He says, the ram with two horns, another beast, represents the kings of Media and Persia, just so you know. So he mentions them specifically by name. This is the kingdom that is going to come after you. It's inferior to you in terms of its culture, but it will overcome you, as in fact it did not long after Nebuchadnezzar's own lifetime. Interestingly, the book of Isaiah, this is written in the 720s BC and into the early 600 BCs. That's when Isaiah is writing. In chapter 45, he says, thus says the Lord to Cyrus, for the sake of Jacob my servant and Israel my chosen, I have called you by your name. Okay? Now that is amazing, because Cyrus is the Medo-Persian king who tore down the gates of Babylon, bringing the Babylonian Empire to an end and absorbing it into his own Neo-Persian Empire. And amazingly, nearly 200 years before this event, Isaiah call Cyrus by his name. Can you imagine? And Daniel later became a servant in Cyrus's palace as well. Can you imagine Daniel saying, hey, I just thought maybe you'd be interested in me showing you this thing. That our God, the God of heaven, told one of our guys, well, almost a couple of hundred years ago now. Seems as though God knows your name. And just exactly as Isaiah describes it, Cyrus begins a migration of the people of God back to Judea. It is a remarkable prediction fulfillment from the book of Isaiah, and Daniel is touching on this as well. I think that's something. The third kingdom is the kingdom of Greece. It says in chapter 8, verse 21, but there's also plenty of allusion in chapter 11. The goat, this is another of the four beast imageries that represents the same kind of four kingdoms as the statue. The goat, he says, is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn is its first king. The broken horn represents the four kingdoms arising from him. Okay, in 331 BC, Alexander the Great won this decisive battle, the Battle of Granicus, and effectively ends the Persian Empire and establishes Greece as the dominant power from the Indus Valley in modern-day India all the way through North Africa into Europe and just the whole populated earth, with the exception of the Far East at this time. But Alexander dies at a very young age, and four of his kings take over his kingdom. And that's exactly what's being described by Daniel here. It is a large kingdom. It is much more massive than anyone before. And then the iron and the toes. Now, we can identify by name Babylon, Persia, and Greece in the prophetic imagery of the book of Daniel. And I've given you chapter and verse correlating each of these things. There are other passages as well. I just want you to understand the incredible continuity of this book. Okay? It is intelligible. It is understandable. It is about the world's empires. It is about one kingdom coming after another. they are mentioned by name until we come to this last one, which we're calling here Rome and man's final kingdom. And again, it's clear this is not being given a name. It just says a kingdom of iron and then mixed with iron and clay at its feet. But by doing some observation, which we will get into much later in our study of the book of Daniel, it will become very clear that this is in fact the Roman Empire that comes and destroys the Greek Empire and establishes control in an even broader geographical area, all the way from England to the north to Central Africa to the south, from Morocco to the west, all the way again into India in the east. And that is the leg of iron that is being described. And then out of that, another kingdom, which is man's final kingdom, described both in chapter 7 and chapter 11, is a kingdom that emerges from the people ethnically and geographically of Rome. But I want to just make some points here. It doesn't mention Rome by name, and so some of us, if we're putting on our skeptic's hat, which I hope you're doing, and really thinking about this stuff, because the implications are huge. Rome is not mentioned by name, even though the other kingdoms are, but Rome fits the chronology of the successive kingdoms being described that are named. Are you following me? Babylon, Persia, Greece. What comes after Greece? Rome. So the last emperor in the Greek Empire, you know, Antony and Cleopatra. And the Romans take over. That's how that happens. So we know that that follows absolutely the sequence of what's being described. Secondly, though it does not mention Rome by name, it fits with the description of Jerusalem's later destruction in chapter 9, verse 26. This is a very interesting passage. We're going to look at chapter 9 as the most mind-blowing thing ever written in human language. I'm not exaggerating. It really is true. And in the middle of this incredible prophecy that Daniel gives in chapter 9, he is describing in verse 26 the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, which historically occurs under the rule of the Romans in 70 AD by their general Titus, who destroys the temple that has been rebuilt, the walls, the Jewish people are exiled from the city. And then he says, and this prince is the same ruler who has a showdown with God at the very end of human history. Okay? Now, why that matters, again, is because when Daniel's writing, Jerusalem is in ruins. It has not been yet rebuilt. That's going to happen in a future generation. But he is able to understand and to see by the vision of God into the future that the temple and the city will be rebuilt and that it will be destroyed by this prince who is to come. Historically, again, without any doubt, this is the Roman Empire, and that prince is representative of the same kingdom at the end of human history. Again, we'll get into that later in chapter 11. Certainly, the description of the power of this iron leg thing fits the description of the awesome, irresistible power of the Roman Empire that lasted for over 1,000 years. And then a description of the future of this kingdom at the end of history, as I said already. So for these reasons, and I think that there are some others as well, but these to me are the central reasons that emerge right out of the text, most interpreters of the book of Daniel, with really very few exceptions, actually, the only exceptions are people who don't believe that it's possible for God to reveal the future, and therefore say that either Daniel's not really talking about this succession of empires, which is clearly he is, or that these are written way after the event, which we also know to be false from our discussion a couple of weeks ago. But so what I'm saying is that this is pretty much universally agreed by interpreters. It is about the flow of civilizations from the Babylonian through the Roman, and then anticipating the very end of civilization itself, when God establishes this powerful defeat of human empires to establish his kingdom on the earth. Pretty amazing. Pretty specific. Pretty concrete, pretty unambiguous. This is exactly the way that history is going, Daniel says. So that Nebuchadnezzar and all future readers will not be left in ignorance, that we will know that there is a God who exists, who knows the future, who knows where this is all going, who knows how the story ends. And so you, indeed, here tonight, are witness to God saying, this is the direction of human history. This is where it's all heading. And so, when we think about this, just sort of, what does this all mean to us? Why should we care to study these things? Just a couple things, I think, come to my mind. One is that the Bible teaches the greatness of humanity. It shouldn't come as a surprise to us that in talking about the empires that define the ancient world and that will be present at the end of human history, precious metals, powerful metals are used to describe that. You know, this is Joe Sixpack. This is an awesome image of great size. Nebuchadnezzar said it was an awesome statue. And humanity is awesome. And why is humanity awesome? Because regardless of our moral and spiritual condition, we are uniquely in the image of a personal God. There's dignity to human life. There's value in human life. And this statue, in all of its awesomeness, represents the greatness that is humanity. The Bible's not negative about human dignity, human life. It's skeptical about our moral integrity and our spiritual condition, but not about our value. And that comes out here. It is also true that as Daniel describes this, that the kingdoms of humanity enjoy a shifting fortune. And as unalterable as we may think that the world is today, I mean, USA, we're up on top. How could it be any other? We can't even conceive of it being any other way. Of course, the Romans couldn't either. Or the Greeks, or the Persians, or the Babylonians, or the Assyrians, or the Egyptians, and so forth. It just kind of goes right on back. And so it is important for us to understand our moment in time, that we may draw a certain sort of security from being the powerful, prosperous nation that we are. And I do think, actually, that there is a legitimate sense of we should appreciate the things that are great about our civilization. I don't think we should be down on that. But like every civilization, we stand on shifting sands. What are you relying on and what do you trust in? The economy? You know, I really hope you're bringing more to the table than that. Your well-being, your health, our military strength, whatever it is, these things are temporary and these things will fade. And this word of God from Daniel makes it clear. Empires, as great as they are, will be replaced. That there is a frail foundation. Now, this is an incredible statue. Gold, silver, bronze, iron. I mean, it just breathes Power. Can't you hear it? Power. It's got a real serious problem. Its feet are made of clay. So the whole thing rests on a foundation that cannot sustain its weight. And it will come to destruction. And so it is that every self-assertion of humanity to arrogate to ourselves the place of God, I define what's true. I define what's real. I define what's right and good. Oh, yeah? No. It will not stand because it is not adequate. The only foundation upon which human life can be productively based is the rock that Jesus refers to in Matthew chapter 7, the last verse of the Sermon on the Mount. The wise person is the one who builds his house on the rock, who is himself. That's a rock. That is a foundation. You know, I think probably all of us here are here tonight, whether we consciously realize it or not, we're here because we realize that there is no foundation for my life, for my family, for anything that matters to me, that is just something that I extract out of this world. The things that we rely on, the things that matter, have to have that inalterable foundation of God himself. And so you sense within yourself, you who are here tonight, just kind of checking things out. You're on the perimeter of what we're describing here. And yes, you have some familiarity perhaps with Christianity. Maybe you grew up in a church and memorized the right lines and so forth. But in your heart, you know, I don't have any idea what does it mean to have in a real tangible way God involved in my life as the foundation of my life. And I sense the insecurity that that brings. I sense that I don't have the answers to the really important questions of life. I sense the emptiness that exists and the inadequacy that is there in myself. And because of the foundation that I'm building on. I realize I'm working hard, but I realize there is an awful lot of smoke and mirrors that comes to the basis that I'm operating my life out of. And that is, you know, God allows us to come to that place because that is reality. He wants us to understand that we are not adequate in ourselves. And it's for that reason, then, that God in his mercy and his love is going to send forth his kingdom. His kingdom. The stone, it says, made without hands, that puts an end to the earthly kingdoms of man and establishes God's kingdom over the earth. The end of all kingdoms is coming. When? We don't know. But on the authority of the scriptures, that is the end of the game. That God will establish his rule on the earth. That his kingdom will be global. That it will endure forever. That is what stands. Being in relationship with God enables us to stand. That is a foundation. That makes sense. And that is what Daniel and his friends, as they understand this vision, and they're in a very difficult place in Babylon, and they're saying, yes, but we know how this all works out. We know what the end of the story is, so we can stay in the fight. I'm not worried about where it all goes. Lastly, again, as I said, God is referred to as the God of heaven repeatedly throughout this narrative, as the great stone that becomes the mountain that encompasses the world in the vision of Nebuchadnezzar. And that means something. It means that the purpose of prophecy in the Bible, the reason why God gives us these images and then in very understandable and clear terms explains to us what these images are first because he wants our faith to be robust and informed. Not a child's faith. Not a child's faith where I believe because mom told me so. And I thought maybe I'd get in trouble if I didn't, you know, or something like that. Daniel is describing here, and the whole framework of prophecy exists to bring men and women into a mature adult faith, an informed faith, a faith that says, I can rely on the word of God because it is concrete, because it discloses things that no human being could know, because it is interpretable in just ordinary human language, like we're describing here tonight. And that matters because it gives us reason to believe God has spoken in those areas that can't be proven in the same way. God's great love for you, God's care for your life, God's offer to forgive you. You know, sometimes you just don't feel all that close to God. Am I right? Or are you one of these people who are just always in there with, you know, it's a wonder that you're not just glowing all the time. I don't see much glowing out there tonight. You know. And so we may feel I'm far from God. We may feel, you know, how could God accept me knowing these things that are really going on in my heart and in my life? You ever wondered that? I look at my broken existence and I think, how could it possibly make any difference to anyone else? How could it possibly matter to the things of God? And maybe we've thought about those kinds of things and have maybe in some ways we sort of resigned ourselves, like, whatever, I'll just fake it till it's over. See, this is where this notion that God speaks prophetically, that God makes statements that are historically factual, that are not just blowing smoke up your skirt, but are really true. See, we can trust that the word of God is real and reliable and trustworthy, and therefore, even in those things that we struggle with in ourselves, if God has spoken, it's the same God who speaks in these areas, who has demonstrated the power of his word prophetically in history. I find that to be very comforting and very important to me. I am not a stable guy in a lot of ways. I get in my head. I get confused. I become disconsolate. I become fatalistic. All these things. And now I've got a choice to make. And you have a choice to make. Will I obey the counsel of my fears and my thoughts and my feelings? Or will I trust the counsel of God's prophetic word? And some of us, we're at an important place of decision in our life tonight. Real forks in the road. There's lots of forks in the road in our lives, but many of us, we're kind of at that place, and we may know it. I've got decisions to make. Will I trust the God who speaks and what he's had to say? Or will I obey the counsel of my fears? See, there is a very practical application to this whole thing. Lastly, there is in this whole thing an invitation to draw near to God. You know, Daniel went to God. Daniel and his friends went to God. And God revealed himself to Daniel. And that same God will reveal himself to you. Yes, through his word, as he speaks deeply to our hearts, that's right. As we seek him out in prayer and we ask, Lord, you know, help me to get it, to understand your thing. He does speak and he does draw us near to himself. And that maybe is where we are, some of us even here tonight. And just, will I humble myself and seek God out? The Bible teaches that God is not hard to find. If we seek him, we will find him. Because after all, the reality is he's been seeking us our whole life. That's why you're here tonight. He's been drawing you, even to this place, to hear these words, that God loves you, that he's demonstrated his love for you in the person of Jesus Christ, who died for you. He took upon himself the penalty for your sin, for your error. And because he's paid that price and put that out of the way, he's willing to extend to you his total forgiveness, to reconcile you to himself. And he's just calling on you. He's drawing you to him and saying, will you trust on the authority of my prophetic word? What I said I would do in history and what I've done, will you trust me with the weight of your sin, with the weight of your guilt? Allow me to forgive you and begin this whole new thing, a whole new foundation, a whole different kingdom that God is at work building in this world.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.